I'm Marty Moscoe-Wayne. Welcome to Ballot Talks on Radio Times. Jeb Bush announced recently that he was actively exploring a bid for the White House. Hillary Rodham Clinton hasn't made it official yet, but sure is acting like she's interested in running for president once again. If that's true and they win their respective primaries, it would almost be like 1992 all over again when Bill Clinton challenged President George Herbert Walker Bush. What does this say about our political system? What are the advantages and disadvantages of political dynasties? And we have two guests. Joining us by phone is Frank Bruni. He's a columnist for the New York Times, where he writes about politics. He's got a new book coming out in March called Where You Go Is Not Who You'll Be, an antidote to the college admissions mania. And Frank Bruni, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Matthew Kerbel, and he's a professor, chair of the political science department at Villanova University. He's also author, co-author, editor of 8 books on mass media and politics, the presidency, elections, and political parties. Matthew Kerbel, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
You're welcome. Frank, if I can begin with you, are we beginning to see 1992 all over again, do you think?
Well, we may be. I mean, it's way too soon to tell. By last count, and I wrote about this week, there are 25 potential Republican candidates for the nomination. So we have no idea what's going to happen on the Republican side. You know, now we have Mitt Romney flirting with another run. To focus too much on Jeb Bush is premature. He remains, though, at least at this stage of the game, one of the front runners and someone who on paper seems to have a great chance at the nomination. On the other side, Hillary Clinton really, front runner doesn't do justice to what she is. So we could, we could theoretically have a Clinton-Bush race, and that's not only a resurrection replay, a recycling of 1992. In some ways, it brings us back to 2000 as well, because Al Gore, as Clinton's vice president, was obviously his heir apparent, and George W. Bush was his opponent. So 1992 comes roaring back, but also 2000 to some extent.
How do you see political dynasties, or perhaps the two political dynasties that we're talking about, Matthew?
Well, I think Frank is right. I mean, we're looking at a potentially another cycle where the names are the same, and it's a little bit like a Back to the Future election. But I would also agree with him that while Bush's name and his family standing and the connections he has give him automatic credibility in the Republican nomination race, there's no question that it's going to be an extremely crowded field. And the advantages that he has, I think, aren't so great that we would say his entrance to the race is going to clear that field. In fact, quite the opposite. He's going to be one of many, many people, each of whom I think, or some of whom anyway, will make a credible claim to the nomination.
I mean, Frank, name recognition can go both ways or a bunch of different ways if you're talking about a Clinton or a Bush.
Yes, absolutely true. Yeah, I mean, we get very those of us in the media kind of get very transfixed by approval ratings and favorability ratings and that sort of thing. And George W. Bush's have ticked up, since he left the presidency. That's because he's not running for anything. That's because he's not responsible for anything. That doesn't necessarily mean that people will be more kindly predisposed toward Jeb than otherwise. Those numbers aren't that meaningful. So yeah, name recognition cuts both ways, and I think the Bush name, while it certainly means people recognize who he is and where he comes from, can also say to them, this is the past, not the future, and can hurt a lot. And it is a really crowded field, and Jeb Bush has some shortcomings. He supports Common Core, which is becoming increasingly unpopular with the right wing of the party. He supports immigration reform, and there are a lot of Republicans, as we're seeing right now in terms of what's happening in Congress with votes, there are a lot of Republicans who are not there. So he has some vulnerabilities in a primary that we cannot guess how they're going to play out.
And if I can go back to you, Matthew, we can't forget the importance of primaries these days in terms of who deciding who's going to be a candidate.
Well, that's right. You have to take a look at who votes in the primaries and the caucuses, and in particular on the Republican side in a very crowded field. And I think Frank is absolutely right. You have Jeb Bush, who is trying to position himself as a general election candidate, as somebody who would be credible to a broader electorate. But in order to get to that point where he has the opportunity to make that case to a broader electorate, he has to come through a primary process that's going to be dominated again by core partisans, many of whom do not agree with the positions that Jeb Bush is starting to espouse on issues like immigration and the like.
What about for Hillary Clinton and through the primaries? And I'm assuming on the Democratic side, we're talking about more sort of liberal members of that party.
Yeah. Hillary Clinton faces a different situation because, I mean, the field, it's almost the exact opposite. You have really nobody else running against her, and she's the prohibitive front runner. However, if you look at where the Democratic base is, there's an awful lot of love for candidates like Elizabeth Warren, who, as far as we can tell, are not running. And assuming Hillary is running, the question is, where will those voters go? And how will she respond to those voters? You know, is she prepared to run on a more populist, progressive platform? And I think that's the big issue for her.
What do you see as the big issue for Hillary Clinton, Frank?
Oh, I think he has it absolutely right. I mean, that's a big issue. That is the big issue. There are some ancillary issues, though. I mean, one of the – you talked about name recognition cutting both ways. In a weird – to a weird extent, experience cuts both ways as well. Hillary Clinton and Jeb Bush, too. But Hillary Clinton, we're talking about her now. She has a lot of baggage. You know, if you are, she has been in public life so long. She has been in public life in such a – at times in such a controversial and polarizing way. That if you are what we call an oppo researcher, an opposition, if you're looking for attacks to launch and dirt to fling about a candidate, well, Hillary Clinton is about as easy as it gets. And yes, some people have heard it all and are oblivious, you know, inured to it or whatever. But some people haven't focused on it lately, and so she's got a long record in public life that both serves her. She can claim I have a lot of experience, which she does, but that also means there's a whole bunch of stuff for an opponent to attack.
And do you think Jeb Bush has similar baggage, Matthew?
I think Jeb Bush has different baggage. The Bush name could be problematic for him if he gets the nomination, because while it is the case that George W. Bush's numbers, his approval numbers are a bit higher because he's out of office. It's because he's out of office. And it would seem to me that Jeb Bush would put the Bush administration, the George W. Bush administration, back in the spotlight. And I don't know that
– baggage by proxy in a way?
Baggage by proxy, exactly.
You know, Barbara Bush said about a year ago on the Today Show, we've had enough Bushes. I don't know if she would stand by those words today, Frank. But I think she – perhaps is speaking for a number of people that just feel like, oh, no, a Bush-Clinton race all over again?
Absolutely. I mean, it was interesting. I don't know if you saw these stories over the last couple of days, but there was a focus group in Colorado, in the Denver area, run by a pollster named, I think it was Peter Hart who did it. And part of what was interesting was how much attention this story got. He was talking only to 12 voters. So you could argue this should not have become the big news story it did. But it became the big news story it did, told you, for starters, how journalists see this dynasty thing as a problem. But in any case, like, I'm reading a headline from the Washington Post on Sunday, a signal of distaste for dynasties bodes ill for Bush and Clinton. And basically what everybody wrote out of this focus group, what all of the journalists who looked at the comments and results wrote, was that these 12 people were very, very chilly to both Bush and Clinton because they seemed like names from the past. And when Elizabeth Warren came up, they all thrilled to that name, or many of them thrilled to it. And it wasn't that they knew that much about the kind of minute policy recommendations of these various candidates. They felt very eager for fresh blood. So in that sense, you know, Bush and Clinton are both in a lot of trouble, depending on who their opponents are. If their opponents aren't people from the future, like we are talking a lot this week about Mitt Romney, if the nomination contest came down between Bush and Romney, well, neither one has much of a claim to the future because they're both people who have longer pass, you know. And if it's Bush versus Clinton in the general election, in some ways the dynasty question comes off the table to a certain extent because they nullify each other on that vector.
Do you think, though, and I know that you've looked at voters and how voters think about candidates, Matthew, but do you think there are voters that like the new, you know, like a new name and a fresh name, and then there are those voters that just, they want the what's predictable, what's familiar, what's reliable, what they know?
Yes, and I think yes to both. And
is that a generational thing, do you think?
No, I don't know if it's a generational thing so much as it's human nature. But I do think that what we don't know is how the campaign would play out. So, for instance, voters may be, or some voters in this focus group may be chilly now to names from the past. But, you know, if it got to the point where those are the names on the ballot, then I think we begin to think about the candidates in a different way.
Huh.
And I think it's very, very early on now. So really, at this point, when we look at opinion polls or even when we look at focus group data, what we're really looking at is a name recognition level of familiarity. People really haven't started thinking about this in any detail. And I think it's just we have to be careful that the way people think about an election 2 years before it's held is quite different from the way they'll think about it 2 weeks before it's held.
And Frank, how much of this is just about money and getting money to run a campaign?
I want to be glib and say everything. You know,
well, it costs a lot of money to run for president.
Well, and money is becoming an even bigger factor, and it is an enormous problem with the system right now. But, you know, it's interesting. To go back to Mitt Romney, because he's been the news of the week, starting with Friday and then through the last couple of days, we've been reading stories that that he is very interested in and seems to be leaning toward another run. How do we know that? We know that. That leaked out because he was telling and calling donors. The fact that the first group of people you would signal your intentions to or test the waters with are donors tells you everything about the process right now and about how money is king.
And I might need a psychiatrist or a psychologist, clinical psychologist, to answer this question, but I'll put it to you, Matthew. How much do you think then Mitt Romney's interest in the White House has to do with Jeb Bush's interest in the White House?
And the fact that Jeb Bush would be going after some of the same donors, the same supporters, and ultimately the same voters. It's a very interesting question. I'm not qualified to answer it as a psychologist.
How about as a political observer, though?
Well, as a political observer, the interesting thing to me is how quickly Mitt Romney telegraphed his interest in running after Jeb Bush telegraphed his interest in running, and how that seems to be accelerating the entire process. Because now it's going to be a race for these donors for cash, and it's going to affect other potential Republican candidates as well.
Exactly.
Yeah, go ahead, Frank.
It's not. If I can just butt in,
sure.
And it's not irrelevant that just yesterday we read, or it was rather leaked, that Chris Christie was forming his PAC. That's all about – he also is going after the same donors that Jeb Bush and Mitt Romney are, and he kind of made clear that he was forming a PAC and full steam ahead, just as Mitt Romney was maybe getting into the race because, to Matthew's point, he kind of wanted to signal to those donors, I'm in the hunt too, don't forget me.
Well, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. It's Ballot Talks on Radio Times when we talk about all things election and politics related. And we are talking about the possibility of another Bush-Clinton presidential campaign. We don't want to get too far ahead of the story, but it does raise some interesting questions about political dynasties, and we have a history of political dynasties in this country. Our guests are Matthew Kerbel, chair of the Political Science Department at Villanova University, and Frank Bruni. He's a columnist for the New York Times, where he writes about politics. We want to hear from you. That phone number is 1-888-477-9444. Are you looking forward to this matchup? Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. We'll be right back. This is Ballot Talks on Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscoe, talking with Frank Bruni and Matthew Kerbel, and we're talking about the possibility of another Bush-Clinton presidential campaign. What do these two names mean to people today? What are some of the political baggage and some of the advantages as well? And we do want to talk about other political dynasties. We have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. We also have some emails here, and you can send us an email at radiotimes@whyy.org. In fact, let me read an email from John. He says, if Hillary gets in the White House, does Bill become co-president with all his baggage? And I'll toss that first to you, Matthew, and then to you, Frank.
Now, that's an interesting question. It takes me back to 1992 when Bill Clinton was first on the political scene, and he referred to his relationship with Hillary as buy one, get one free. And certainly he governed that way, giving Hillary tremendous responsibility over the health care plan that he developed early in his administration. So I would imagine that We would certainly be in uncharted territory because we've never had a first man. But it would seem to me that given the history, there would most likely be some kind of substantive role for Bill Clinton in a Hillary Clinton administration.
Frank, do you see him as a liability, advantage, a mix?
You know, it's interesting because we keep on talking and, with these two potential candidates about everything cutting both ways. But
exactly.
It is true, everything does cut both ways. I think the fascinating thing about Bill, for starters, is during the campaign, because there's a really fine balance to be struck here. He is a largely unrestrainable person. I mean, you've seen him, you know, at the Democratic convention. He was supposed to speak for X amount of time. I think he doubled that.
Yes.
That's both a harbinger and a metaphor. Let's say she gets the nomination, since she seems to have very little competition, and let's say she's in the general. They have to be very careful because Bill is enormously beloved, and you certainly want to use him out there on the trail. But especially if you're campaigning to be the first female president, you don't want him seeming to claim more of the spotlight than the woman. That sends a very bad message. Also, he's not the most disciplined man. We've learned that in several different ways over the course of his political life. He is going to say things, or he is likely to say things, that are going to stray from her platform, that are going to maybe contradict something she said, that are going to invite controversy. It's going to be something her campaign is going to have to very, very carefully control. In the same way that Jeb's going to have to worry about what his mother says, Hillary's going to have to worry about what her husband says.
Oh, we have families we have to deal with.
And these are sprawling and complicated families. It's a journalist's dream, but it might be a voter's nightmare.
Well, is it a journalist's dream, do you think, Matthew?
I think at this point it certainly is, because I think one of the reasons we're talking about this today is because it's 2 years really before the election. And I think that this prospect of Clinton versus Bush is filling a void right now. It's a news void. And so, yes, I mean, I do think it's a journalist's dream. Whether or not it's a voter's nightmare, I can't say, but it would be a campaign strategist's nightmare.
Why do you say that?
Well, I mean, exactly what Frank was just saying. You know, Bill Clinton, nobody tells Bill Clinton what to do. And he is something of a force of nature. So I think that a potential general election campaign would have to use Bill Clinton tactically. And it just may be a difficult thing to do.
But could you also say that if politics is the family business, and if we're talking about dynasties, and there have been dynasties in this country's past, is that you have people that are expert in something or good in something or passionate about something. It just happens to be running for office or being an elected official. I'm looking at you, Matthew, and then Frank, I'd like to get you in as well.
Yeah. Well, there's no one better at running for office than Bill Clinton. I think there's no question about that. But again, he won't be the name on the ballot. And that's why this becomes a potential issue.
What do you think, Frank?
I think you bring up a good point. I mean, we've been talking a lot about the liabilities, and it is true, and it can't be overlooked, that each of these candidates, and again, I want to keep building in the caveat that I don't think it will end up being Hillary and Jeb. I think one of them, but maybe not both of them. But each of these candidates does bring a storehouse of information, you know, a storehouse of experience. They bring an unrivaled access to experts on various policy things. And that shouldn't be belittled and overlooked. I mean, we curl our lip at dynasties because we like to believe we live in a more egalitarian country. That's often an illusion. But there is a reason why, as you use the phrase family business, I think very wisely, there is a reason why people go into perpetuate and remain successful at the family business, and it's because at that point they have a DNA that includes a lot of expertise.
Well, I'm looking at the Adams family, not the scary family, the Roosevelts, the Kennedys, the Bushes, the Clintons. We've been talking about
Harrison.
You reminded me. Perhaps Rand and Ron Paul. I mean, so
the Kennedys.
Indeed. So we have a history of political families or political dynasties.
We certainly do, and it goes back to the beginning of the country and actually before that. So one of the things I would say is, yes, I would agree that family business is exactly the right way to put it. But I would also point out that we've been talking about this as a political phenomenon. It's also a cultural phenomenon. And while there are unquestionable political advantages to having the name when you want to run for high office, this is a cultural phenomenon as well. And I think people look at the Clintons in a way as a part of our popular culture. I think to a certain extent, maybe the Bushes as well, certainly the Kennedys. So whether that's an asset or a liability, I know we're maybe we're both starting to sound like broken records. It's a little bit of both. It certainly gets you
there.
We
don't mind nuance on this show. Okay. No, we do not. We have a comment from John, sort of picking up what we're saying here. There's more to Hillary and Bush than baggage. Both of them have individual strengths. Could they flesh them out? And I think we were just talking about that. But as we're saying, it could be an advantage. It could be a liability. We have a tweet from ATP. Bush, fool us once, fool us twice. Please not a third time. And there are people, Frank Bruni, who feel very strongly about both of these names, but certainly about the Bush family as well.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's interesting. You said fool us once, fool us twice. I think, by my read of things, most historians, and I'd be very curious for Matthew's take on this, most historians now, and I think most Americans, grade George H.W. Bush very, very favorably as a president. And I could easily make the case to you that he was a terrific president. So it's harder to do that with George W. Bush. A lot went wrong under that administration. There's a lot of stuff that's very disturbing. But if you're judging Jeb, it's hard to say that. That's too alliterative. If you're judging him by his forebears, I think his father actually is a point in his favor in the eyes of historians and the eyes of most American voters. But to what the other listener said, they are their own people. You know, we're talking about, let's stay on Jeb for a while, we're talking about him, you know, in terms of his lineage. Jeb was a two-term governor of Florida. By many people's opinions, he governed way too conservatively, but he did develop a lot of expertise, for instance, on education. He's a big advocate of education reform. That's a very polarizing issue, but you cannot say he doesn't know his stuff on it. When I have listened to him give speeches, when I've been in the same rooms with him, he seems to me like a man who is very, very well educated on policy, whether or not you agree with his conclusions. Mm. So to give him his due, I think he's got a formidable mind. I think he's got a firm grasp of the issues. He just doesn't come down on the issues where a lot of voters would like him to, and that's what elections are about, figuring out whether a majority of voters agree with his conclusions.
On the point of whether George Bush or George W. Bush would be assets or liabilities, I agree that over time, historians and political scientists who look at prior administrations have a fresh perspective, and it's often a different perspective than what contemporaries felt. I do wonder how much of an asset the first George Bush would be for Jeb Bush, because he's really been out of office for a quarter of a century. Mm. And I wonder if there won't be a generational difference in the way voters would look at a potential Bush-Clinton matchup. And by the way, I don't think we're going to see it either.
You don't either.
No, I don't think we'll see both of them. But if we were, I think there could potentially be a generational difference between voters who remember George Bush, and particularly George W. Bush because it's more recent, and voters who just don't.
Well, and picking up on what Matthew said, and I just scribbled Ken Burns' The Roosevelt Series, but I mean, it is interesting, Matthew, what history does to presidential candidates. And, you know, when you never know what was that truly what happened, or is it what happened when people were experiencing it in real time?
And in terms of a contemporary campaign, I think what matters more is less the history and more the way the history is told. There's a lot of mythology about past presidents. There's a lot of mythology about the presidency itself. And I think for either of these candidates or any candidate who is running in the context of a family dynasty, a lot comes down to how successfully they're able to frame that narrative.
Let me just quickly reintroduce the two of you. It's a Ballot Talks on Radio Times, when we set aside an hour to talk about ballot-related issues, whether it's elections or politics or issues. Talking with Matthew Kerbel, chair of the Political Science Department at Villanova University. He's written a number of books on mass media and politics, the presidency, elections, political parties. Frank Bruni is a columnist for the New York Times, where he writes about politics. And he's got a book coming out in March, which, frankly, I would like to talk to you about, called where you go is not who you'll be, an antidote to the college admissions mania. But in this hour of Radio Times, we're talking about political dynasties, and we want to know what you think of past and present dynasties. Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Frank, you had an interesting piece about these two dynasties that we've been talking about, and even the relationship between Bill Clinton and George Herbert Walker Bush, the father, a kind of almost like a father-son relationship.
Well, yeah, Barbara Bush had said in an interview, I think it was about a year ago, that George H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton had become very close over recent years, and she revealed that Bill Clinton visited them every summer in Kennebunkport. And she made the point that Bill Clinton never knew his father. His father, of course, died in a car accident. I think it was while his mother was pregnant with him. I can't remember the exact timing. But it was really fascinating because I mean, that was a bitterly, bitterly fought election. And I remember back in 2000 when I was covering George W. Bush's campaign, I remember sitting in their living room with them in Kennebunkport talking about George was then about to, it was in the run-up to the Republican convention. It was clear that he had the nomination. But the general election hadn't gotten underway. And the way that Barbara Bush talked of Bill Clinton then, Bill Clinton was in the last year of his presidency, it was so bitter, it was acidic. Time does amazing, I mean, it doesn't just heal wounds, it does something more magical than that. And I think there is, as a book by Nancy Gibbs and a colleague of hers at Time magazine about a year or two ago showed, I think time brings ex-presidents closer together because there is a very small pool of people who have that set of experiences and memories.
And Barbara Bush has said, I love Bill Clinton.
She says that now.
She wasn't saying it back then.
from the years 1992 to 2000, that was not the song Barbara Bush was singing.
Yeah, and not surprisingly, Matt.
Maybe you should have a psychologist join us, Marty.
Well, there is this whole thing about presidents and their daddy issues, and whether it's Obama and his father, who he's written about, or Bill Clinton and his father. I mean, I don't know how deep we can go, and you're looking at me,
Matthew. I wrote a whole column about that a couple of months ago.
I know you did. Flesh that out for us. Now, go ahead.
Well, no, it's astonishing. If you look at the history of the presidency over the last decades in particular, but even going back further, you have a lot of men with various iterations of daddy issues. And it's easy to say, well, every guy has daddy issues, but it's particularly pronounced in the presidency, and I think it says a lot about the forces that goad a person toward achievement, you know, whether they're trying to, you know, compensate for a sense of loss or inferiority, whether they're trying to live up to a sterling example. You see those dynamics very, very frequently in the men who run for or win the presidency, and I think you see it very frequently across politics.
Mm. Well, and I've even seen it or heard it said that George W. Bush was, in a sense, avenging his father or perhaps besting his father when he went into Iraq and got rid of Saddam Hussein, something that his father didn't do. I'm looking at you, Matthew.
Yeah, I've heard the same thing. I think it's you know, it's complicated what makes a person strive for an office like that. In particular, when you think about what you have to go through in order to attain that office, and what it means to actually put yourself through that on a daily basis for years and years, it really is phenomenal. And regardless of what may be, you know, driving you to do that, clearly something unusual is driving people to do it who decide to take it on.
We have a comment from Vicky. She says, the Clintons are not a dynasty in the way that the Kennedys, Bushes, and the Romneys are. Bill is the first one to have high office. Other families are sons and daughters of millionaires or certainly very rich people.
I think that's a really good point. And you know, you do have an unusual situation here where you have the spouse of a president running for office. That is a different thing than the offspring of a president running for office. Uh-huh. So I think, you know, from that perspective, I think that the Clinton situation is different from some of these others. I guess that might change if Chelsea decides to run for something.
One never knows. Anything you want to add to that, Frank?
Well, yeah, I mean, when we're using the word dynasty, and I think it's an appropriate word even for the Clintons, we're using it in a less exactingly literal and a more colloquial or metaphoric sense. I mean, when we talk about political dynasties, I mean, most properly a dynasty is generational, but when we talk about political dynasties, we're really talking about the sorts of history and benefits and the sort of perpetuation of a legacy that happens. And in that sense, Hillary has some similarities to someone like Jeb Bush, because she is definitely seen in the context as, and her kind of renown is amplified by the politician who came before her with the same surname. In this case, it's a husband. That lends a difference to it, mm-hmm. but there are a lot of similarities to the dynamics. And in terms of money, I know this keeps coming up again and again with the Clintons. The Clintons have tons of money. they didn't have it early in their life. I mean, that's a big difference between like the Bush family and the Clinton family. Bill and Hillary, when he was governing Arkansas, when they came into the White House, they did not come in with a bunch of family money. They didn't grow up with an enormous amount of family money, although Hillary grew up plenty comfortable. But at this point in their lives, they are very rich people, and by dint of their time in politics and the crowds they run in and the respect she has, Hillary is going to have an access to donor money that trumps any other Democrat.
You have to be rich to run for president, don't you, Matthew,
these days? Or know people who are.
Or know people who are.
But
do you think, and we're almost about a minute before our second break here, and I'm looking at you, Matthew, but do you think there's something undemocratic about these political dynasties we've been talking about?
Sure, of course. But it's not unusual either, because this goes back to the very beginning. So you've always had families who were well-connected and who constituted the elite in this country. And yes, I mean, it is at its core undemocratic.
Because they get more attention. They get all the sort of benefits, of name and status.
Well, they have the advantages that you need in order to mount the kind of run for the presidency that we're talking about. You know, I remember a reporter asked George W. Bush during the 2000 primary campaign whether he thought he would be the leading candidate for the Republican nomination if his name was George Walker. And he just shrugged because, of course, he wouldn't be.
All right, because he was George W. Bush. Well, let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation. It is Ballot Talks on Radio Times, and we are looking into the future, imagining a Clinton-Bush run for the White House, although both of our guests don't think that actually is going to happen. But it does give us a chance to talk a bit about our electoral process, why we have political dynasties in this country, and what to make of the race that is beginning to take shape today. Frank Bruni, columnist for The New York Times, where he writes about politics. Matthew Kerbel, chair of the Political Science Department at Villanova University. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and send us a tweet at @WHYYRadioTimes, and I'll read them on the air. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Ballot Talks on Radio Times. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking with Frank Bruni and Matthew Kerbel about our political system, about familiar names like Bush and Clinton and Kennedy and Roosevelt and Adams and Jefferson, and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Frank, when does the campaign begin, or does it never end these days?
I think you've in the same way you hit the nail on the head with family business, your appendix to that statement was absolutely right. It never ends. I mean, I think it began in a particularly intense way this very month. You know, as soon as we got past the midterms, as soon as the lame duck session ended, I think this week in particular, what with with the Romney news, the Chris Christie State of the State, Scott Walker just gave his State of the State. There have been some smart articles written about how various governors are giving State of the State addresses that are essentially auditions for their presidential bids. I think we're fully underway now. Now, but I think what you're also asking is when will we really know? When will we have formally declared candidacy?
Yes.
Not just Facebook announcements and all that. I think we'll know for sure who's running in a formal way May, June.
That makes sense to you, Matthew?
Yeah, absolutely. I think we'll know by spring. This field is going to have to sort itself out. And on the Republican side, there are so many possible candidates. You know, it's just hard to imagine a debate stage with all those podiums. Mm. So it may just be that some people who want to get in, who are sending signals that they want to get in the end, either can't get in or can't stay in. There's only so much money available, and it's not going to be able to support all those candidates.
But it's so interesting that looking at the Republican Party, you've got this, you know, crowded field of candidates. You look at the Democrats, and you got Hillary Rodham Clinton.
assuming we have Hillary Rodham Clinton.
Exactly. It's hard to imagine. Maybe I'm crazy
here. Well, I think
here.
You have Bernie Sanders and Jim Webb. We do have a couple of others.
Okay.
They're just very, very low on the radar right now.
That's correct.
And is that because Hillary's sort of dominating everything?
Yes, and it's because of the point in time. One thing I can say as a member of the media is if they end up being the only ones there with her, they will end up getting more attention than they're getting now, because nothing frustrates, bores, exasperates the media like a foregone conclusion. And so if there is any way to write about, present Jim Webb, say, as a credible threat to her, he'll be written about that way for at least a short period of time, because what we in the news business like and what we make money on our organizations is tension, not foregone conclusions.
And what do you – I mean, these are turbulent, difficult, anxious times, Matthew. What do you think voters want under those kinds of circumstances?
Well, I think if we look at the primaries, what voters want on the Republican side may be different than what voters want on the Democratic side. To me, the really interesting dynamic is going to be how Republican candidates deal with Republican voters during the primaries, because right now I think you still have a very active, vital Tea Party base. I know a lot was written in the last political cycle about how Republicans were able to avoid nominating candidates that the Tea Party supported that were not viable in the general election. But I don't think that's the same thing as saying that the Tea Party isn't still ascendant in the Republican Party. And I think we're going to see this particularly during the primaries. So it's going to be very interesting to see how this crowded field of candidates addresses those concerns with an eye towards the general election, because often the concerns expressed by the Tea Party do not translate into viable general election positions.
Matthew, anything you want to add to that? And then we'll get to some callers here. I'm sorry, Frank, do you want to
add? That's okay. I think there is an enormous overlap between what in a meta sense, in a larger sense, between what Republican and Democratic voters want. What I think is really interesting, beyond all this dynasty stuff, et cetera, about this election is if you just edit for the moment out some of the very recent, more encouraging unemployment and such numbers, we're living in an era when, if you look at public opinion surveys over the last couple of years, we're living at a really, really interesting time where a majority of Americans, in a way that hasn't been true in the previous 20, 30 years, no longer trust that their kids are going to have a better life than they do. And there are a whole bunch of other numbers in this arena, but basically they paint a picture of a country that is pessimistic in a way it hasn't been in the previous quarter century, and that really has doubts or a kind of sense that America has turned the corner where its best days are behind it, and we're trying to just make sure the days ahead aren't bad. I think the candidate who convinces people with more than just platitudes that the country's best days really can be ahead of it, and that their kids may really have a better life than they do, if a candidate can convince voters of that and articulate that, Republican or Democrat, that's who's going to win this election.
And from a dynasty perspective, then the next question would be, can somebody who in the mind of the public is associated with that recent past make that kind of critique?
Oh, meaning great someone question. Who sort of lived it in
who,
a way?
Who's associated in the minds of the public with the last 15, 20, 25 years.
I've noticed, and it's on the Democratic side, but also on the Republican side, that a number of people that certainly look like they're interested in higher office or the White House talking about income inequality. And I think that's I saw Marco Rubio, who was on Jon Stewart's show, talking about his new book, which apparently is all about income inequality.
Yeah, and I think that goes to Frank's point about making this statement about whether America's best days are still ahead of us. I think you're going to see a populism of the right and a populism of the left. They have completely different solutions to this question, but they're both addressing the question. And I think that is going to play out in the campaign, no question about it.
Hasn't Jeb Bush already adopted an early slogan of the right to rise?
I think that's right. Mm-hmm.
Right. Well, that's all. I mean, that slogan is all about social mobility, and it's also kind of all about what I was talking about America rising again, you know?
Let me get David from, looks like, Central New Jersey to join our conversation. Hi, David. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call, Marty.
You're welcome.
I think we like dynasties for the same reasons we like divided government. It gives us this comfortable feeling that nothing will change, nothing will be done that's new, and everything will be very predictable.
Are you saying, David, that Franklin Delano Roosevelt did nothing new when he was president?
No, not at all. And actually, yeah, that goes to another thought I wanted to express. The one exception to what I said, Marty, is the only time, and Lincoln has a famous quote about this, the only time we like anything to happen is in a crisis. It's the only time we actually come together as a people. Otherwise, we're deeply neurotic about power, and it goes back to King George. And we create presidents who can't do anything by the structure of government, and then we complain about it.
Well, David, I want to hear what my guests have to say about it. I hear you chortling, Matthew Bruni. Go ahead. Excuse me, Frank Bruni. I don't know why. I've now completely cloned the two of you together. Frank Bruni, go ahead.
We're sort of like the radio Brangelina, right? Our
yes, exactly.
I think the caller's point is great. I do think we set our politicians up for failure, you know. And in all of the complaining that we do about our sclerotic and dysfunctional Congress, you know, it needs to be pointed out we have the power to change that. You know, we go to the polls, or increasingly people don't go to the polls. And we have the power. I also was thinking, we're talking about dynasties. At one point we haven't said, and it's kind of obvious, but I think it's important. You know, I don't think dynasties are democratic. I don't think they're the best thing in terms of the kind of mythology of this country or the equal opportunity ethos of this country. But individuals surprise you. And at the end of the day, they are not just members of a dynasty. They are individuals. And I think of Ted Kennedy. You know, he came into office, you know, amid a storm of kind of personal scandal and all of that stuff. He was seen in the beginning in large measure as someone who was just coasting on the Kennedy name. By the time he died, by the time he left the Senate, he was one of the most accomplished, respected, hardworking, principled senators in that chamber. And if he had been judged solely as the member of a dynasty, it would have been completely unfair. So people are individuals who have accomplishment in them, perhaps, that has nothing to do with their surname.
David, thanks for the call. Anything you want to add to that, Matthew?
Yeah, I think that just to speak to the caller's point about how people feel comfortable with a member of a dynasty because they won't change anything.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that applies to policy. I think we really can't say that it applies to policy. But I think it does speak to a certain comfort level that people either are familiar with or believe they're familiar enough with the name to be able to listen to what that candidate has to say and perhaps feel comfortable voting for them.
I see a comment from Mike. He's saying, I haven't heard the mention of the Taft family. They were a political dynasty, played a large role in national politics.
Apologies. Yes.
Yes. We should include the Taft family as
well. If we expanded this beyond the presidency, we could go on and on and
sure.
on. I mean, you mentioned Rand Paul before. He's the son of Ron Paul. You know, in the last Senate election, you had Sam Nunn's daughter running. You know, Murkowski's in the Senate. I mean, it goes on.
Jimmy Carter.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
And on it goes. Well, here's a comment from Michael talking about political dynasty is beyond just presidential candidates. What comes with a dynasty is the familiar faces who'll be in think tanks and government positions and all of that. Do you agree with that, Frank?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the question.
Well, it's just that, you know, you run for office, you win office, and then you end up in a think tank or I guess, in a position of power once you leave that office.
Oh, we're talking about post-presidency.
Yes, yes, yes.
I don't think
yes.
most presidents end up at think tanks. I think they end up out on the speaking circuit making, in Bill Clinton's case, up to $700,000 a speech.
Is that how much he makes?
Yeah.
I seem to remember there was one speech he gave in a foreign country that got a lot of media attention that was something that's not his normal price. But I mean, the normal price for Hillary right now, if the reporting on it is correct, is something like $200,000 per speech. Yeah.
Wow.
I mean, one of the reasons, and this is going to sound very cynical, but it really is true. One of the reasons you sometimes have an enormously crowded primary field, whether it be on the Republican or Democratic side, some of those candidates know that their chances of, like, catching lightning and ending up in the winner's circle is below 5%. But they also know that if they just get a little bit of traction for a short period of time, they've just boosted their name recognition exponentially. And therein lies book contracts, therein lies speaker fees that aren't $25,000 but $75,000. And those calculations are made.
And not to sound too cynical about it on top of that, but some candidates don't expect to win, don't even want to win.
Uh-huh.
But they want to be on the largest stage in the world.
And yes. have that platform to
have the platform. whether it's
never underestimate the force of ego in all of this.
Yes, always ego. Let me get Greg from looks like Princeton Junction to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Greg. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes. Good morning.
Good morning.
I had a question.
Sure.
How far, if we look back in our history, our U.S. history, when is it that we began having candidates announce or declare for the presidency 2 years before the election? Does it go back to the Reagan time or Kennedy or even earlier?
Let me toss that to you, Matthew.
John Kennedy, if memory serves, announced his presidential campaign January of 1960. So it was in the same calendar year. Really, what changed first was money. Running for president simply became astronomically expensive, and it takes a long time to drum up the kind of support necessary to sustain a presidential campaign. So I think it's certainly a more recent phenomenon than we might expect.
And largely because it just takes so much money. I mean, and the time that it takes to get the money to keep a campaign going.
Money, organization, endorsements.
Right.
You really need to move early. And of course, as long as anyone is moving early, everyone else has to then react.
We have an email from Beverly. She says, both of your guests have said they don't believe there will be a Clinton-Bush general election race. But why not? Why do they believe that? Frank Bruni?
To me, it's just about it defies the laws of gravity and the laws of probability. You know, it's that simple. When you kind of look at the number of potential outcomes, when you think about all the things that can happen between now and then, it's just hard for me to believe that as a matter of probability that we're going to end up with the neatness and tidiness of a dynastic Bush-Clinton race. And I also think it just doesn't feel to me like that can happen when you look at it in the context of where we are and how many people desperately want to turn the page. When you look at the focus group I was talking about earlier, where everybody was sort of chilly to Clinton and Bush and wanted to talk about new names, that just suggests to me that it's improbable that in this climate we end up with Bush-Clinton.
Do you agree with that, Matthew?
I do. I also I have to see the way Jeb Bush is going to position himself relative to Republican primary voters. I'm not convinced yet that he has a compelling enough case at this point anyway to win the nomination.
We have an email from Elizabeth. She says, give me Elizabeth Warren! Exclamation point. I mean, there are on the Democratic side, she has some passionate supporters. She says she's not running, or you know, however you read those tea leaves, Matthew.
I think, yeah, passion is the key word, Marty. It's interesting because if you look at the polling numbers on Hillary Clinton, really has tremendous support, really overwhelming support among Democrats. But it's not a passionate kind of support. If you look at where the energy is in the Democratic base, it really is more with a candidate like Elizabeth Warren, and I think that does pose a challenge for Hillary Clinton.
Frank, we have not said the word President Obama during this hour, and we have about a minute before we have to say goodbye here. Looking ahead, and it's interesting, his poll numbers were pretty much in the tank through a lot of 2014, but they're beginning to hit around that 50% level. What role do you see him playing?
I don't know. A lot of it depends on where those numbers are. I mean, let's think back to the midterms. Most of the Democrats running in the midterms asked him to play no role at all. They kind of stuck their arms out and said, please stay on that side of the Potomac. You know, we're doing fine out here without you. It depends on how helpful he seems. It seems like he would be based on poll numbers. It also depends on his own personality. How is he feeling as he takes, you know, his final lap in the presidency? Is he feeling, let's say Hillary's the nominee, is he feeling like Hillary's election is the validation he wants? Or does he see it as something separate from himself? So there are also just sort of temperament and characterological things that come into play.
Very quickly, Matthew, final word.
Whether Barack Obama is an active participant in this election or not, he will be a factor in the election because you have the Democratic Party looking to win a third consecutive term. That's a challenge in its own right.
Well, my thanks to both of you for joining us today on Ballot Talks on Radio Times. Frank Bruni, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And he's a columnist for the New York Times, writes about politics. He's got a new book coming out in March called Where You Go Is Not Who You'll Be, An Antidote to the College Admissions Mania. Matthew Kerbel, thank you very much as well.
Thanks, Marty.
You're welcome. He's a professor chair of the political science department at Villanova University, and he is working on his ninth book. Go to whyy.org/ radiotimes. And you can find out much more about this program, including how to download a podcast of the show, how to follow us on Twitter, find us on Facebook, and check us out on satellite radio. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thanks for joining us in this first hour, Radio Times. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.